call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:36 p.m. on Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. Present today in the room, we have Representative Thompson, and online, we've got Representative Carpenter. Online, we've got Representative LeBon. And in the room, we've got Representative Edgman, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Rasmussen, I think it looks like I don't see her online, just to be sure. And then also here, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. This afternoon, we'll hear introductions of three pieces of legislation, HB 187, HB 64, and HB 30. So those are state agency publications, Fishery Development Association, and workman's comp, death benefits, and partial impairment, permanent partial impairment. And so with that, we'll start with HB 187. That's a state agency publications by Representative Kaufman. Representative Kaufman, if you'd like to come up, if you've got staff with you, I believe Matthew Harvey, if you could both put yourselves on the record and go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you. For the record, Representative James Kaufman, South Anchorage.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Representative Kaufman.
And thank you to the chairs. I am thankful for this hearing, and I'm surprised to be called up first, so I'm getting ready quickly. So thank you. HB 187 is a simplification bill. It's part of the type of quality management, cost reduction, efficiency improvement type bills that we've been working on. In its current form, as reading from the top of the sponsor statement, HB 187 in its current form is intended to conserve resources expended in the production, processing, transportation, distribution, storage, and disposal of excess state agency publications. In essence, that's referring to, I guess, in honor of it being Marmot Day, that some refer to as Groundhog Day, to prevent us from doing the same thing over and over again when we don't really need to. And the idea of this bill, as Mr. Harvey will explain in a bit, is for the executive branch to go through its list of publications that it creates, look for opportunities to either consolidate, reduce, if it doesn't make sense anymore, let's not do it. Kind of like my favorite movie, Office Space, where everybody's working on those TPS reports and nobody knows what they do with them. So if there's any way we can quit producing reports that we don't need, there's an opportunity. And so we'll get into the specifics with Mr. Harvey if there's no questions yet.
Okay, please continue.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Representative Kaufman. And real quick, I'll just go over the sectional analysis. Fairly short. I like to look at Section 2 first because this is the repeal and reenactment of Statute 4499.220, which currently requires a list of publications to be produced by each state agency. And since this is already statutorily required, what we're adding to this is the identification and highlighting of publications deemed to be outdated, duplicative, or excessive, or that could be consolidated with other publications, or which could be delivered in electronic form if they're required to be delivered physically. This list of publications, including highlighted publications, is required to be electronically submitted to the governor and both bodies of the legislature. And then using that list, looking at Section 1 of the bill, Section 1 amends 37.07.020 to add a requirement for the governor to submit legislation to remove or amend the statutory requirements for publications deemed to be outdated, duplicative, or excessive, or that could be consolidated, and which of those could be delivered in electronic form. So Section 2, make the list and identify and highlight which ones the agencies believe can be improved, and Section 1 is submit that list and the legislation to make those changes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. We can go to committee questions if we've got some questions, if you're finished with your. And And if I could maybe just, it may be more of a comment, but a little bit of a question, I guess, and that is, it seems like it would be kind of a subjective, you know, there's always going to be some publications out there that a lot of people don't read, but maybe one or two or five or 10 or whatever that number is are. So I guess, you know, how would you do that dividing, you know, where is the line of what you print versus what you make digitally available? And I that this might be kind of an open-ended question, I guess. Do you have any thoughts?
Yes, thank you to the chair. The process, since it's legislative, what it's doing is creating a feedback loop where you do the assessment. You know, so all the people that are tired of filling out TPS reports, they say, you know, we can quit doing this. But then that rolls up into that piece of legislation, that, you know, the proposal essentially to, hey, we can reduce doing this. But then through the legislative process, that's where we look to see, you know, who are the clients for that. That's kind of the change management piece of it. And so a change is proposed, but the legislative process is where, well, is this a viable proposal on this list, or who are the stakeholders? Has everybody been considered? So that surfaces it. A little bit of public testimony that, no, I line my, you know, birdcage with that thing every week, and so we have to have that, or whatever the use for the document is, you'll hear about it through the public process.
Thank you. Representative Edgeman?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think, didn't we pass a bill like a few years ago that is kind of a direct precursor to this, and maybe the bill didn't make it to the entire process, but I thought it did. And I remember being at this table, our conversation centered around balancing the need to save money and save trees and resources, and how a digital version was just as useful as something in writing. You know, and I agree with all that, and you know, and I don't oppose your bill or anything like that. But we talked about how people out in rural Alaska didn't have the broadband capabilities. That was a few years ago, to be able to get things digitally in real time. And of course, that is beginning to change now. And we had a presentation on broadband yesterday. Well, we're still not quite there yet in a number of states. Hope that some point every community will be served by fiber optic in the state. So that's, I guess that would be the only, you know, and I don't know if that's a medium level caution or a smaller caution or something like that, but just to keep that in mind, because a lot of times some of these reports are pretty important, and you know, people out in their villages, they don't check, go on the computer and check to see if a report from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission or something is online. They get it in the mail. That's where they've been getting it. So I just sort of put that out there as something to keep in mind with your bill. But generally, you know, I like where you're going with it. I think it's well intended.
If I could say, just Representative Rasmussen's also online. Do you have a comment, I guess, on Representative Edgeman's comment first before I go to Representative Wool?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Edgeman. Exactly. That's we thought about that. That's the reason why this is not structured to mandate that, you know, to the executive branch, hey, go through and delete stuff that you don't feel you need anymore. It keeps that check, you know, that I call it the change management piece. It's the legislative process that we can see if anybody would unduly be affected by the lack of a paper publication.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think Representative Edgeman was referring to a bill by Representative Christ Tompkins some years ago, and I recall that, and it brought some discussions out, and I discussed it with him and some of my other colleagues, which I do support not wasting money and paper and resources. At the same time, we get presented with reports in hard copy a lot of times in our mailboxes here in the Capitol and other ways in the mail. And I get a report from an agency or a group, and I flip through it and read it and get a lot of good information out of it, where someone said, well, that information is available. You just have to go to www.state.org.gov/2603. You know, I'm not going to do it. And it requires active investigation, where if someone gives me the Department of Labor Trends magazine, which gets distributed, and I'll flip through and read it, Will I research all those data points on my own? Maybe not, but I will get the information when it's presented in a publication form. So I think there's a passive active component to if it's online somewhere, yeah, I know the information is out there. So I do think that public printed publications still have value. Obviously, we still use a lot of them here, and maybe too many. I don't dispute that. So however you can somehow balance that, because I do think there's value in getting publications.
Are there any questions or comments online? And I don't see any.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Carpenter.
Sorry, getting the unmute button. Time to catch your request there is sometimes challenging. I do have just a brief comment. I think the value of this doesn't necessarily lie in the amount of paper that we'll save, but the habits that we may form within the organizations, the various governmental organizations, to challenge our thinking on how to do things more efficiently. And I think our state has a long ways to go in many respects to welcome itself to the digital age. Many people, especially younger generations, are doing everything online. And because we're challenged with it and we like a paper copy isn't where we're headed in humanity. We are moving towards more digital. And so I think this helps us in two fashions. One, moving us towards that digital connection with the younger generation, and changing our kind of our thought patterns within the organization to think about doing things better as a matter of habit or as an organizational improvement habit. So that can lead to other areas of the organizations, not just paper products. So I'm happy to see this going forward.
Great, thank you. I've got a question. Our local newspaper out of Nome is a very popular newspaper, and I would say a lot of people really rely on that. They get a lot of their information. People look forward to each week when it comes out. And one thing that we've seen at the state level is fewer announcements being put in the newspaper, and then people are not seeing them, thinking we're saving money by not, you know, doing ads. So my question is, does any part of your bill affect any announcements? Sometimes you look at the newspaper and in the back you see all the classifieds, and some of these can be kind of long and they look like they're almost maybe even a report or a publication. I don't think it's your intent to go into that realm, but I just wanted to see what your thoughts were, just so it's on record, I guess.
Thank you to the chair. The core intent is really around the publications that are created within the executive branch, and the amount of work that goes into that. You know, I think many of us have been in situations where we produce a report that we wonder if anybody reads it, and maybe sometimes information is created in parallel. Somebody's producing the same dang information over here, and you wonder sometimes. It can be a bit numbing if you're in an organization that has you doing work that you don't think adds value. So it's an opportunity to create that review process. But specific to announcements, I'm not really thinking about, you know, where you would, like, you know, buy media for announcements or place an ad that might be a paper media. That would I think exist in the kind of the communication plan of that agency, not so much in the publications.
Okay, thank you. I am slowly stepping into the digital age here, and I saw that a orange or a yellow circle was around Representative LeBond's face there on Zoom, but I didn't know what that was, and now I realize it's essentially waving your hand in the digital way. So with that said, Representative
LeBond. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh. Yes, my hand is up. Thank you. I guess this is... the savings would be time and cost of printing reports if everything was digital. Does the maker of this bill have an opinion about savings that could be realized down the road, or is it, would it, you just have to pass this bill to find out what the savings might someday be?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm going to defer to my chief of staff, Matthew Harvey, who's been chomping at the bit over here.
thank you. Through the chair to Representative LeBon. Representative Christ Tompkins did have a similar bill that was kind of a blanket, everything will be delivered electronically, and he was kind of the one who we, I wouldn't say stole the support document from, but he was the one who did the work to get that supporting document that said there's 189 statutes that require reports, and the estimate in the fiscal note of his bill was that the printing cost to the state was about $585,000. And because it's not a blanket, everything will be delivered electronically, and there are things which probably should be delivered physically. Don't think it will be quite that much, but that's from the past research and Representative Christ Tompkins' bill, roughly what they had said in 2015.
Okay.
Thank you for that answer, and that does put a number, at least in concept, to the savings. And you know, it is the evolution of reporting to go digital, and even in the banking world, financial statements, bank annual statements, et cetera, are now digital online, and that's where they're found. There's fewer and fewer of those being printed. So that's a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Josephson and then Thompson.
Through the chair for the sponsor. Representative Kaufman, thanks for bringing the bill. The governor's bill, and I apologize if this has been asked, the governor's bill could recommend the elimination or modification, so it would be entirely in his or her purview to say, for example, the report on the status of women in Alaska isn't helpful or isn't necessary, and then the legislature would be on the defensive and have to modify the bill itself. Is that right? So for each one of these reports, we would have to step up to the plate if we didn't like its elimination.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson. The legislature would receive the bill and would have to move it through the legislative process. So I don't know if we would be in as defensive a position. Because there would have to be the will to move it, and there would be the amendment process, there would be the public hearings, there would be a robust workout of it. But I think that's part of the benefit too, is that it surfaces what's being produced, and it assures that what is being produced has value through debate and discussion.
Okay.
Follow up?
I mean, some of these, for example, I don't know. I have in front of me a 2015 research report. Is that part of your packet? Okay. Some of these, for example, the annual report on mining activities in the state, I don't know. It just strikes me that there'd be a tremendous amount of interest in that. But maybe your point is that then we would quickly dispense with it and keep it on the list.
Yes, sir. Through the chair. That the exercise is not to get rid of things, Representative Josephson. It's to assess. It's to look to see if we have opportunities for improvement. It's just to avoid that we've always done this, and so we need to keep doing it because things do change. But for instance, we may have that mining report. Parallel information may be available in an online format. And so, but the printing presses are rolling. And with that, if you take the cumulative costs, so you may look at the cost of production of a document. There's also the cost of transport, of storage, of ultimately of disposal. So it ends up in a landfill if it doesn't get composted. So the value chain has a lot of opportunities for improvement there. And it's not to mandate that anything isn't reported. It's to look at how and assure that we're periodically, on the cycle, that we're making sure that we're we're still delivering value with what we're doing.
Okay, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think this is a great idea. I've seen this similar things done in the past. This report that we are looking at right now that has all of these things listed was produced in February of 2015. I'm sure in the last 7 years that we have probably added more than what this list shows. About 6-7 years ago, we were trying to figure out how to save the school district's money and looking at all the extra people they had to hire to make reports to the state, one of them being everyday morning attendance. It had to be compiled by the school district and then sent to the State Board of Education. We asked them, well, what do you do with these reports when you get them every day? They said, oh, we just put them in a file. We don't use them for anything. Why are we requiring, like the school districts, to hire an extra person to do nothing but compile all of this information and send it daily, these attendances? You know, those type of things are what I think is you're trying to eliminate and save the state some money, probably in personnel besides just the cost of printing and things. So thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you.
Okay.
May I comment on that?
Sure, absolutely. Representative Kaufman.
But I really want to stress the job dissatisfaction aspect of doing work that you don't think adds value. It's one of the worst things to be in a position where you're tasked with something, but in doing it, you think nobody ever reads this. I know because they never contact us to ask any questions about it. It's going into the round file somewhere. And that has a cost itself in terms of job satisfaction and other value-added work that the person could be doing. So it's not always just the simple dollars of we didn't print this and that's the savings. The savings can be much deeper in the actual production, the whole value chain, all the way to disposal of publications that aren't needed. So thank you.
And we've got a fiscal note. I've got here that Caroline Schultz is available. However, I don't see her online, but I do see the director of Neil Steininger. If you'd like to come up, I believe you're going to walk us through the fiscal note. The control code on that is IXFKU. I believe it's the only one in your packet. So with that, Mr. Steininger, if you can put yourself on the record and just give us a quick review of that.
Yes, through the for the record, Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. So the fiscal note for House Bill 187 is a $0 fiscal note. In review of the bill, we believe that the work involved in the bill of compiling the report and putting together the legislation required under this bill could be done within existing resources.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions of the committee regarding the fiscal note? Anybody online regarding the fiscal note? And I don't see anybody, so with that, thank you very much, Mr. Steininger. Any comments, Representative Kaufman, on fiscal note? I assume you're...
Well, thank you to the chair. Yes, it's zero now, but I believe it's actually a savings bill. So not just zero, even better than that. We can That's use the money for something better.
Nice little twist to that. I didn't see you going that direction. Good. Thank you. Okay. So, Representative Wold, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Two comments, I guess, about employee satisfaction with work that they think isn't valued. Is this about making printing out the forms or even the reports or even doing the reports? Because I know that the legislature likes requiring reports and putting it in statute. We would like a report every year, seeing how this is going or what have you. In fact, we were in the committee the other day, and we were reminded that we requested a report last year. No one really remembered, and thank you. And the report was produced, and we're like, oh, yeah, I remember that old thing. So, but if we hadn't asked, and I don't know that anyone would have ever looked at it, not because it wasn't printed, but because we forgot that we asked for it, or maybe its utility was of question. So that's one question. Are we reducing report requirements or just the printing of them? And I forgot my second point. conversation. I can't remember.
Take the first question.
Yeah, take the first one. Take the first one.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Wolf. Yes, it's in the total production of it, and that's there may be documents we don't produce, and the reasons could be that we determine that they're not value added for whatever reason. Maybe circumstances have changed since the requirement existed, you know, and we want a report on the production of buggy whips, but we're not building those anymore, so we don't need that, but we're still producing the report. That can happen. The beauty of a large and complex organization is that there's usually fairly painless efficiencies that can be found if you start just creating little mechanisms like this to go in and create the discussion. So we may ask for something. It's easy to ask for something, and it's easy not to see the work that it takes to get it done. So it's about the total production, and not just the total production, but if you think of the total existence of a report, from the conceptualization of the information, the compiling of the information, the production of it as a report, the transmission of it, whether that's printing it and then trucking it, flying it around, you know, all the things that go with that, everything from the emissions with transport and ultimately the disposal of it for better or worse, be it landfill or composting. A lot of publications, the inks are toxic, so there's just layers and layers of goodness in looking at what we don't need to do that we may have asked for that is for some reason no longer relevant, at least in that format. And so produce or print, that's going to be the discussions we'll have in this review cycle if we implement this.
Follow up? Well,
yeah, thank you. And I guess that still gets to the cause of when there's a statute that says a report must be produced every so often. Is that going to be, to undo that statute is not simple, I don't think, and require a statute. So reduction in statutory requirements to produce publications. So I'm in support of that. I guess I remember my other point was, this is a zero fiscal note. This is a finance committee. I know we tend to look at things with fiscal notes. So is there a fiscal implication of this bill, even though it says zero fiscal note, and is that why the Finance Committee is looking at it? And that's to anybody, maybe Mr. Steiniger, who is gone.
Representative Kaufman?
Timing was excellent there.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Wool, there was a point where, you know, is there a cost? Don't know. And I think you know, the referral happened, but it's been looked at, and again, it's not zero. It's actually a cost reduction bill, because if you think of it, everybody knows the dang list of reports they have to produce, and they know which ones seem to have an intrinsic value, at least from their perspective, and so it wasn't seen as, you know, by the departments as a new list they would have to make, a new report, right? So I think the referral is just an artifact, but I think it's an opportunity. I'm happy to be here to talk about ideas like this that we can do if we can cull through things and look at where we have opportunities to improve.
Okay, and I don't see any further comments or questions. So with that, this is our first hearing on this. We'll give folks an opportunity to mull it over and talk amongst folks and see if there's any concerns. And so for now, we'll set HB 187 aside, and we'll take it up at a future hearing. So thank you very much, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.
So next, we are going to consider House Bill 64, which is the Fishery Development Association bill and assessments. It's by Representative Stutes. And we've got Representative Stutes's staff here, Mr. Fate Putman, and we'll hear an introduction from him first, and then we'll see what questions the committee might have. And it looks like we've also got some invited testimony here. It looks like we have three people. We also have a number of folks online available for questions regarding the fiscal notes, and as well as alleged legal and so forth. I guess maybe I'll just go and throw the names out right now. for available for questions, we've got Alpheus Bullard, Ledge Legal, Forrest Bowers with ADFNG, Commercial Fisheries Deputy Director, Phil Doherty, who's the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association Executive Director, and Nicole Reynolds, Department of Revenue Tax Division Deputy Director. So if folks have questions. So with that, Mr. Putman, if you could put yourself on the record and go ahead and introduce the bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Merrick, for having us here today. We're about to talk about one of my favorite topics, commercial fishing. My name is Fate Putman. I'm staff to Representative Louis Stutes. I'm here today to provide you with an overview for Representative Stutes, who's the prime sponsor. Unfortunately, she's not going to be able to join us today due to other commitments. What we're looking at in House Bill 64 is an idea to establish regional fishery development associations and allow for the development of commercial fishing management assessments in order to support the growth of new and developing fisheries. The new, I call them RIFTA fisheries, are prospective fisheries within the geographic region and is not currently regulated by the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. The definition of a developing fishery is a fishery within the geographic region where neither the optimum yield nor the has been reached or the sustained yield has not been estimated, and the commercial harvest has not recently been developed or stock assessments conducted. And the years of declining revenue and reduced budgets have lessened the Department of Fish and Game's ability to manage and establish fisheries, even less so those developing fisheries that are of the reference of this legislation. To adequately manage the state fisheries, the Department of Fish and Game must perform annual surveys and assessments of fishery resources so that Fish and Game can identify the biomass and sustainable yield of seafood as required under the state constitution, Article 8, Section 4, which mandates that all resources of the state be developed using the sustained yield principle. And in the cases of these new and developing fisheries, the funding just isn't there to do these assessments, surveys, and studies. Therefore, Alaska Department of Fish and Game is not allowed the fisheries to open for commercial fishing since there's no harvestable biomass and it's unknown what the biomass will be. Our office was contacted by a constituent in Prince William Sound who's been fishing in the area. He's been looking at Tanner crab in the Prince William Sound area and fish that was closed about 30 years ago because of the drop in the biomass then. And so because they didn't have the funds to open it, they didn't open the fishery for 30 years. So annual surveys are now being conducted in Prince William Sound on Tanner crab biomass, and we know that there are adequate Tanner crab to support commercial fisheries. So the fishery is now open access commercial fishing in the Tanner crab in Prince William Sound, which means basically that anybody who wants to fish can obtain an interim use permit from CFEC and can go fish for Tanner crab in Prince William Sound. Those open interim use permits eventually might lead to a limited entry, but that's not the subject of today's hearing. HB 64 was designed to let developing fisheries open by providing a source of funding so the Alaska Department of Fish and Game can do the annual surveys required for the biomass. This survey is required to open a fishery and keeps the fisheries open if the annual survey shows that there is an abundant seafood to be harvested. Currently, our constituent can fish for Tanner crab in Prince William Sound with the CFEC interim use permit. However, the necessity for legislation still exists for other fisheries that need to be developed. HB 64 creates a mechanism to fund the management of new and developing fisheries. It allows the creation of regional fishery development associations, which are nonprofit organizations that represent the fishery stakeholders. These development associations may elect to levy upon themselves an assessment that would be then fund the studies done by the Department of Fish and Game. These fees, called management assessments, are collected by the fishery resource itself at the time of sale so that the fish buyer would collect the RIFTA assessments and remit those funds on a quarterly basis to the Department of Revenue, and those funds are housed at the state treasury until appropriated back to the associations. The RFDA works in tandem with Fish and Game to create an annual operating plan consisting of things like stock assessment surveys, payments of Fish and Game, so they can conduct those surveys. This isn't the first time the state has addressed the issue of developing fisheries, of course. Currently, there are dive fishery associations in statute. The Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fishery Association, who you mentioned that Phil Doherty online is from that organization, has used this model since 1998 to manage geoduck, sea urchin, and sea cucumber fisheries in Southeast Alaska. So as the bill was developed using those statutes, the dive fishery statute 64 has given new developing fisheries the mechanism which we hope will be able to fund themselves and support their own annual operations in order to become an established fishery. These are known fishery resources, and each of these fisheries provide personal income for our fishermen and women and provide revenue for the state once the fishery is open for commercial fishing. As the state of Alaska continues to see reduced returns from from other things besides commercial fishing, it makes sense to develop and expand the fisheries, which are revenue generators and for the state and job creators for those thousands of people who want to become commercial fishermen in Alaska. I also have a sectional analysis. I don't know if you want to go through that now or maybe later, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any interest in the sectional analysis? I think we're okay.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, that's my presentation on the bill, and maybe I should call on us, see if you have any questions about the legislation.
Great, thank you. So we'll take questions from the committee first for Mr. Putman, and then we do have three people who are also going to be providing invited testimony, and they are McKenna O'Toole from the Cordova District Fishermen United, also Ronald Blake, Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association, and Mike Mickelson, Cordova District Fishermen United. So so we'll also have an opportunity to ask them questions as well. So with that, any questions for Mr. Putman first? Representative Edgman? Oh, I'm sorry, and also I'd like to note that Representative Johnson joined us earlier. Representative Edgman?
Yes, thank you for the bill presentation, Mr. Putman. Maybe I didn't hear it, but wondering if you might be able to explain the difference between a regional seafood development association and a regional fisheries.
Thank you, Representative Edgman, and through the chair. I learned a long time ago, back when I was serving on the commission, that I am, you know, there are a lot of people that are a lot more experienced in these things than I, and that's why I have these folks online that maybe we could punt to one of them. I think Forrest Bauer can answer that question for you very adequately.
Mr. Bauer, if you're there, can you put yourself on the record and go ahead and answer the question?
For the record, this is Forrest Bowers, Deputy Director, Alaska Department of Fishing Game Division and Commercial Fisheries. I couldn't hear the question.
Representative Edgman, if you could repeat the question.
Yes, yeah, so I was looking through the fiscal notes, and the Regional Seafood Development Association is administered through the Department of Commerce, and the Regional Fisheries Development Association would be administered through the Department of Fish and Game. You probably didn't hear the discussion we had a moment ago on digital publications and savings and government and so forth. I don't mean to be snarky, but I think it is a pertinent question. Why wouldn't you have one association? Why would you have two and two different agencies?
Well, that was the RSDA was established through separate legislation, and that was the decision of the legislature at that time to house it in that agency. It's the RSDA collects funds from the fishery to for marketing and enhancement of the value of the fishery on the marketing side, and so I think that's likely why it was housed in Commerce, whereas this bill is focused more on the stock assessment and the biology, so that makes it more appropriate to be related to fish and game. Thanks.
Let me follow up, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I appreciate that response, and I think that's probably the rationale behind it, but I'm not convinced why you'd have to have two different entities, and I'm guessing you don't need more staff to run this. Mr. Bowers and I guess I'm just wondering why it's not in the same shop. And I see a hand raised out in the audience. Maybe later on public testimony there might be some further clarification on that.
Yeah, maybe there should be clarification. I'm not familiar with the marketing side of things, so I can't be of assistance there.
And maybe if you'd like to go ahead and come up and while we're on the subject, put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Jerry McCune. I'm president of Cordova District Fishermen United. That's a very good question, but the marketing associations were created. You have to have a boat by the permit holders of that gear type to put the money in there, and they control the money. So it's a little bit different than what we're trying to do with the new fisheries. And Forrest is right about, you know, it's about the biology and getting surveys to open new fisheries. And the two wouldn't fit together because of, if you read the bylaws of the marketing, this would not fit. And plus they're, you know, mandated by the legislature to spend their money a certain way on marketing, and they're limited. It's been a while since I looked at all the bylaws and stuff, but that's the difference between the two wouldn't match up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, and I think that's a good breakdown, Jerry, if I can call you Jerry. And I was just trying to look, you know, for a distinction between the two because they do have different function, like you say. The RSDA's been around for a long time, but similarly, they may have some carryover duties as well. But I'm not disputing where it's located or anything like that, but it's just, you know, we're in the era now where we're trying to consolidate and efficientize, if that's a word, as much as we can. So thank you.
Great. Representative Josephson, was this for
it's
Jerry?
For his associates.
Newfound Lifeline.
Lifeline, Jerry McCune. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Chair, I'll start with Mr. Putman. When we talk about the opening of new commercial fisheries, do you mean things like the Tanner crab that existed, albeit a long time ago, in Prince William Sound, I think you said?
Yes.
Or is this a wholly new species that no one's ever fished for before?
Well, I'll ask Jerry to answer that. Jerry McCune?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Josephson, we're looking at two different fisheries right now that have never been opened in Prince William Sound, the cucumber fishery and octopus and different things that we can bring to keep people working in the winter and keep fisheries going so the town has some kind of income and employment in the winter. And a lot of these fisheries there's a couple down here in Southeast, but never been developed anywhere else. So this would be also for statewide for anybody else to look at any new fisheries, not just Prince William Sound.
New question. Is there a point in time in the process where a non-commercial user could, through public hearing or some other means, you know, speak to whether or not the new fishery should open at all?
Mr. Chair, this is Fate Putman for the record. Representative Josephson, I think the venue for raising issues such as that would be the Board of Fish. They do the allocation of fishing resources, and that's probably the time when someone could bring that forward before the Board of Fish.
Great. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, question regarding the dive fisheries. I know this isn't your bill, but you were using it as an example, you know, a successful example of economic development. And I'm curious if since the inception of the dive fisheries statewide effort, has the general fund supported or had to sustain the dive fisheries in a way that maybe this concept would down the road have to also be sustained? That's the biggest risk in my mind, is that we're creating something that then down the road becomes something that we have to support with general funds. I'm very optimistic that this would not, I'm hopeful that it is an economic stimulus and creates opportunity for us. I'm just curious if somebody can speak to that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter, and through the chair. Yes, that's the general idea of this RFTA, is to not use general funds, to use the funds associated with the collection of fees from the fishermen as they catch the fish and deliver them to the buyer, so that there's funds to pay for assessment so they can continue to fish in the future. I do also want to offer an opportunity for Phil Doherty, who's online with the Dive Fisheries Association, to answer that question and probably give you a better answer if that's okay with the chair.
Yes, Mr. Doherty.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman. I'll ask you, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. Just check that. Anyway, for the record, my name is Phil Doherty. I live in Ketchikan, Alaska. Been here since 1978, and I am currently the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Trees Association. And again, just for a little background, prior to that, I was the area management biologist for commercial fisheries in the Ketchikan area, starting in the early 1980s and going through the 1996. So the question was, I believe I'm trying to answer here, has general funds paid for the dive fisheries since the assessment tax and the legislation back in 1998 has come through? And the quick answer to that is no. We continue to tax ourselves. We have three different species that are taxed at a different rate. Those are sea urchins, gooey duck clams, and sea cucumbers. And the money is taxed through the legislation at the time of delivery. It's just like any other, just like the fisheries tax. When the fishermen deliver at the dock, that tax is written onto their fish ticket. It moves on to the Department of Revenue and then back to us at the end of the fiscal year. And then we take that money and sit down with the Fish and Game Department with an annual operating plan. And we give the Fish and Game Department the amount of money they need to do the assessment work and the management of the fisheries. And since we've been underway, there has been, as far as I know, no general funds given to the Fish and Game Department to assess and manage our fisheries. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr.
Carpenter? Okay. No follow-up. Okay. So, any further comments, Representative Edgman?
Yeah, I just want to say that I like this bill, and obviously, I think it's you know, anything with developing fisheries and giving organizations a leg up is I think is badly needed. And I really appreciate the bill sponsor and Mr. McCune for coming forward with this bill. But just to get that, maybe a sticky wicket question or two out of the way. So in order for, as I understand it, developing fisheries has to have some commercial value, right, in order to have money, in order to be commercialized to the point where members can pay an assessment fee, can have the wherewithal to form a non-for-profit, there's an election that needs to take place, but yet there's zero fiscal notes on this bill. Am I missing something there?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Edgman, the concept here is to allow these fisheries to occur under a commissioner's permit. So that's a fishery that hasn't existed yet, and it's a developing fishery. So a commissioner's permit from the Commissioner of Fish and Game issues a permit to allow the fishery to happen, but it's not technically an open fishery yet. It's sort of like a test fishery. And then as the fish are caught and things are delivered to a buyer, maybe they only get to fish for 6 hours or something like that. They bring it, sell it to a buyer. That's where the fee is collected. And then eventually those fees build up enough to be able to afford to pay for the assessment so that it can open for a full fishery. And you get an IUP for that, and you know, an interim use permit for a fisherman to be able to go out there. Of course, any fisherman at that point, once it's open, can go out and fish. And then they have to come in annually and do an assessment to determine if they can continue to keep it open the next year. And so as those fish are sold to the buyer, a piece of that money, anywhere from 2.5% up to 30%, if they so choose, can be used for these assessment payments.
Thank you, and that's a great refresher. We did talk about this a couple of years ago on the Fisheries Committee, I think, and I appreciate that.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to lend my support and thanks to the bill sponsor for bringing this forward today. The exciting thing about this kind of development creates more economic opportunity, provides more jobs, and yet we're working with a renewable industry, a place where you can, if it's managed correctly, you can continue on you know, into perpetuity, and it's just renewable as opposed to some of our other extract resource industries. So I'd just like to share that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So I think we'll move into our next phase. So thank you very much, Mr. McCune. Won't keep you in the hot seat for too long there. We'll move over to our invited testimony here. And we have three people. We'll first go to McKenna O'Toole. If you could put yourself on the record, state your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, for the record, McKenna O'Toole speaking, CDFU Shellfish Finfish Division. I'd like to thank the committee today, through the chair, I'd like to thank the committee today for making time to hear this. I guess a little bit of background on this. I spent years working on trying to develop some of these defunct and underutilized fisheries, not just tan and crab. I, you know, tried to go through commissioner's permit processes for sea cucumbers, squid, green sea urchin, skates, you know, a lot of these things. And the department, with, you know, their current budgetary constraints, they always, even if they wanted to work with us and thought that there was a viable opportunity, there just wasn't a funding mechanism in place. And a few years ago, some local fishermen formed a fisheries development committee, and it seemed like it just made sense to us that if there wasn't funds available for these assessments, that, you know, we should be able to contribute these funds to the department for a fishery that we believe is viable. And it came to light that there wasn't really a legal avenue to do that through legislation. The only existing legislation like this, as you've heard, is through SARDFA, and I participated in the dive fisheries in Southeast for well over a decade now, and I just have to say that it seems like the most functional working relationship between industry and management that I've seen in my career, and I really like that this has kind of been modeled upon there. I brought this issue of funding holding us out of these fisheries to Louise and to Sam Raybung, and I'd like to thank both of them for all the work they did putting this bill together and finding the most streamlined way to approach the issue. Some of the questions, just real quick, that I heard go by earlier, I'd like to touch on. As far as the RSDAs are concerned, Mike Mickelson, that's here with me today, he's the former president of our local regional development association, Seafood Development Association. And so if you guys have further questions on that, you can perhaps direct that to him. As far as defunct versus new fisheries, there are a lot of fisheries that this could benefit that once upon a time were thriving fisheries. And because they haven't yielded any returns in so long, these fisheries can go decades without an assessment of any kind of survey or anybody looking at them from the Department of Fish and Game, because they just don't have the budget to keep track of everything going on. Some of those species would include herring, tanner crab, dungeness, red, blue, brown, king crab, razor clams. This bill also would cover new fisheries, such as this Norton Sound salmon fishery that's operating under commissioner's permit right now, to try to explore the viability of having a purse seine fishery in an area that's never seen one before. It can be used for hooligan, California market squid, green sea urchins, whelks, octopus, skates, dog sharks, black rockfish. There's a lot of underutilized resources within the state, and it just seems to me with how much money we're pumping into trying to develop mariculture, we need to just start looking at what we already have and consider that at the same time. Anyway, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do we have any questions, Representative Edgman?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for that testimony, and I think the distinction between RSDAs now and what this bill proposes is very clear-cut, and I don't have any further questions about it. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. O'Toole. Next, we'll go to Ronald Blake, Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association. If you can also put yourself on the record.
Ronald Blake, through the chair, yeah. I participated in the dive fishery. I started in Southeast. I started in 1990. I've also fished quite a few different spots in the state. And I just want to echo what McKenna said about the relationship in the dive fishery between the department and the dive association. And the only real thing I think I could really add to what McKenna said is that, you know, we've been working with the department on developing this cucumber fishery, and one of the things they asked us to do was to form a dive association. And through the research, we realized that we cannot legally do that as a way to help fund this without having the fishery first. And this is a mechanism that allows us to meet that need with the department that they had asked us if we could get set up. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. I don't see any questions from the committee, so we'll next move over to Mike Mickelson, Cordova District Fishermen United. If you can also put yourself on the record.
For the record, Mike Mickelson, Cordova, and Cordova District Fishermen United. Yeah, I think, you know, these guys have pretty much covered all the points, but I just want to say that I support this, and I think, you know, from working with biologists already, there's definitely evidence that there's, you know, for example, enough biomass to support some of these fisheries, and that's the key thing is that there's the fish are here. We just really need this in place so that we can start taking advantage of it. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. I don't see any questions from the committee, so we'll next move over to the fiscal notes. And first, Mr. Bowers from Fish and Game, he'll review the commercial fisheries fiscal note. The control code on that, and that's on the bottom right of the fiscal note, is BCQGF. Mr. Bowers, if you could put yourself back on the record and go over the fiscal notes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Forrest Bowers, Deputy Director, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Division of Commercial Fisheries. See, I think the fiscal note I pulled up online has got a different control code than the one you mentioned, but I imagine it's the same information, and we've got a zero fiscal note on this. There'll be relatively little staff time involved for the Department of Fish and Game in fulfilling our duties under this bill. Basically, we're just verifying that, you know, the associations qualify under the provisions of the bill, and then working with the associations in developing what's essentially a cooperative agreement on how any funds that would be or any revenue that's generated from this tax would be used in stock assessment. And then in terms of the revenue piece, it's indeterminate, it's unknown. There's no way at this time that we could predict, you know, how much revenue would be generated as a result of this bill. Thanks.
Great, thank you. So zero fiscal note. So you mentioned that the control code was different. Is your component number in the upper right, is that 2965 on the version that you have?
Yes.
Okay, so I think we're okay. I don't see any questions on the fiscal note, so we'll move to the second of three that we have, and that is, next is John Hagiagi, Executive Director of Commercial Fisheries Entries Commission Fiscal, and he'll be going over fiscal note with control code XQGQE, and John, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, my name is John Hagiagi. I believe I was supposed to stand by to answer any questions, but from the perspective of the commission, this would be a costless bill to implement, and we see no issues with it moving forward. Thank you.
Okay, so also a zero fiscal note, and I don't see any questions from Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There was one specifically for the last I have one in general when it's appropriate.
Okay, Did you say it was a question regarding a fiscal note or just on the bill?
On the bill itself.
Oh, okay. Okay. We'll round back to that. So no questions for Mr. Hagiagi. So we'll next go over to the Revenue Tax Division's fiscal note, and that's Deputy Director Nicole Reynolds. Ms. Reynolds, if you can put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Reynolds. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. We submitted an indeterminate fiscal note in terms of revenue impact of this bill. As someone else stated, it's we're not able to predict, what species are going to be subject to this assessment, what the assessment rate is going to be. So for those reasons, we submitted an indeterminate fiscal note. As far as implementation cost, we submitted a zero fiscal note for that. It would place a small administrative burden on the Department of Revenue, and we would absorb that with our existing resources here.
Great, thank you. It looks like we've got a question, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And my question is in regards to personal use fishery. And has there an assessment been done on what how the personal use fisheries may be impacted if we turn or if create a new commercial industry on a particular fishery? And it may be a premature question because the actual study and process of getting the fishery stood up hasn't happened yet, but I'm curious if we've thought down that road very far as to what the impact might be to some personal use.
I'll take that question. Thank you, Representative Carpenter, through the chair. There is oftentimes little relation between personal use and commercial fishing because the Board of Fish makes allocations to the different groups about assessment. Now, if you're thinking of salmon, all salmon is currently limited, so that's one of the areas that is of interest for personal use. But I don't know if I could directly respond to that without a particular fishery I have in mind. But there are, I think, many of these fisheries where the Department of Fish and Game will look at them and decide, well, there's a potential that you'll be crossing over into personal use, and maybe we won't allow commercial fisheries to occur there. If the biomass particularly is too small to allow for that, but does allow for personal use, I think that decision would be left to the Department of Fish and Game to decide, if that answers your question.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the answer, and I think it is a premature question, but an important one. And as long as there's a process going forward that we can make that assessment later, then I'm happy with that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, any further questions, Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Putman, with the establishment of these regional fishery development associations, if that occurs, is it just kind of like who decides who gets to be a part of the association or doesn't get to be a part of the association? Of course, the motivation for being part of the association is you eventually, hopefully, you get a limited entry permit so that you can actually execute the fishery that you're interested in. But is it never going to be a problem of too much demand to be a part of the fishery compared to the ability to sustain that fishery?
Yeah, that's always a good question. Thank you, Representative Ortiz, and through the chair. How to sustain a fishery if there's too much pressure is really what you're asking. And that's really the function of the Limited Entry Commission, to look at those things to see where the pressure is being applied. Is there enough resource to go around for both personal use and commercial access for the funding so fishermen can go out there and fish? Those are difficult questions. I think that, the Department of Fish and Game may have a better answer than I can give you on how those decisions are made, but I certainly know that, commercial fishing is something that we depend on in Alaska, but also we depend on personal use fishing too. So maybe the Department of Forest Power could give you a better answer on that question.
I guess as a clarification on the question, does the way it work, there's a group of interested people that come together to form a development association, a fishery development association. From that group of people, is there just kind of a natural process that happens as to how many in that group of people actually get to participate?
Yeah, no, I think I'm getting what you're asking, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. Yeah, if you can see in that list of folks that could be on the association, it'll include people from municipal government. It might include people from the city council, you know, all the way up to people who are out there commercial fishing. So I think it's a loose, right now it's sort of a, it's defined rather loosely so that anybody can be part of the association that wants to be. And then they would all get a ballot to decide how they would assess the fishery. And not all the people that are on the association are fishermen. So, you know, that's kind of how it would work. Because it's loosely defined who that group is, we don't really know until it actually happens and how those associations would be formed. And I'm not familiar with the dive fishery, but I think most of the folks there are actually divers and are part of that fishery, and they are the ones that cast the ballots, and I know you've had several pieces of legislation to deal with that. That isn't, you know, clarified in this bill, we'll say that, of how to deal with when you don't have, you have latent permits and people aren't voting, and those no votes, a no vote is a when someone doesn't vote, it becomes a no vote, and that creates a problem there. So there are issues that they need to be addressed, and the sponsor does realize that, but right now we've set it up loosely so that anybody who wants to be a part of the association and join the association can be a member of that and vote in the election on whether to move forward, if that helps.
You bet. And is Mr. Doherty online? Is still he still with us?
Mr. Doherty, are you there?
Representative Ortiz, yes, I am.
So, Phil, tell us a little bit about how SARDFA works. Is SARDFA ongoing organization that's open to people coming and going, or how do you control that organization?
I'm sorry, Mr. Doherty, if you could just put yourself on the record.
Phil Doherty again from Ketchikan, Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association.
Great. Thank you.
The way our legislation is set up is that if you are a permit holder, that is a permit holder through the Commercial Entry Fisheries Commission, whether it's an interim use permit or a permanent permit that you have the ability to sell, you are part of the association. We don't have anyone else besides a permit holder that is part of the association. So as soon as you, well, today you would have to go buy the limited entry permit. So as soon as you buy that limited entry permit from someone who's looking to get out of the fisheries, you automatically become a member of the association. And what that means by being a member of the association is that when you land your resource, the three dive species here in Southeast, you pay your tax, and that tax goes to eventually ends up with us. And so we don't have anyone from outside, anyone but permit holders in for our association are a part of the association. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Doherty. We've got a question from Representative Carpenter and then Representative Wool.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I forgot to take my hand down. Please disregard me.
Oh, okay, thank you. Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The assessment that the group, the self-forming group, comes up with, this is to raise funds to do a fish and game study, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
If so, how do they determine the assessment rate, and is it self-determined, or does Fish and Game say we need this much money to perform our study?
Thank you for the question, Representative Wool, through the chair. You will note in the legislation that part of the ballot that the folks that form this association will have is a question of what level of assessment do you want to apply to your fishery. So it starts at 2.5% of the value of the fish up to 30% of the value of the fish. And if you elect to assess yourself, let's say 10% of the value of fish towards the fishery, then that 10% is housed at Department of Revenue, and then given to the Department of Fish and Game to conduct the biomass surveys so that they know there's enough fish there to have a fishery. That's really the way it's designed to work.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Cochia, through the chair. I understand that. That sounds good. If I was in that group, I would probably want to select a low assessment rate so I could retain more. I'd put some aside for the study by Fish and Game. But what if it wasn't enough? Would Fish and Game say, that's not enough, we need a higher percentage? Or would they say, well, we'll have to do another season or another fishery, another opening? I mean, it would be in the interest of the fishermen to have a low assessment, whereas in the interest of Fish and Game to have a higher one, or whatever is required to do the study.
Understand the question. Thank you, Representative Wohl, through this chair. If there's not enough funds collected, there will be no fishery. That's part of the impetus for the fishermen to have a higher amount, because if Fish and Game can't do a biomass study, they can't open the fishery, and there will be no income for those folks. So that's a decision they'll have to make on their own. But the Commissioner of Fish and Game has the ability to decide, you know, approve the ballot. So he will approve what level is selected. And if the Commissioner of Fish and Game decides that 2.5% is not going to cut it, and I won't be able to do an assessment on that amount of money, he may reject it and send it back to the association and say, you'll have to come up with more money or I won't approve the ballot to be sent out. That's why there's flexibility in this legislation.
Follow up?
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. It makes sense. If they have a ballot approve a certain assessment, it goes to the commissioner. He says that's okay. They do an opening. It's inadequate to fulfill the study. Would the recourse be to do another opening or to what's the recourse then? I mean, I don't know if the commissioner knows what a study would cost before the opening, and I guess that may be a question for commissioner level person. Yeah. Or someone with more experience than me, obviously.
And possibly myself, Representative Wohl, thank you very much. But I think the Fish and Game has a really good handle on this. I know they're online and they can speak to it, but they have a pretty good idea how much it costs to do assessments. And so if they think that your group is so small that amount of money we're going to collect from you is not enough, the commissioner will probably reject. Fish and Game will reject that number and ask for more money. And so I think there'll be a balancing back and forth to make sure that this is functional and that the fishermen can actually go out and start a commercial fishing industry based on the assessments. And they can't go forward without an assessment, so there's a chicken and egg situation, right? So if that answers your question, Representative Wohl.
Thank you. One last question.
Follow up?
I guess if they didn't have enough to do the study and they did this experimental opening, they couldn't keep sort of repeating that process and therefore have a default fishery. They would have to establish a commercial fishery with an assessment. They couldn't just keep repeating the process, correct?
That is correct. If you don't have a sustainable yield from the fishery, you're violating the Constitution. So I know Fish and Game is very careful about this, and they don't allow commercial fishing to occur unless there is a biomass, and they don't know if there's a biomass without a study. So I think that's where you'd end up with that one. Thank you.
Great. I don't see any further questions of the committee. So, Mr. Putman, any closing comments before we this is our first hearing of this bill in this committee, so we'll set it aside and again let folks kind of just talk about it amongst ourselves a little bit and see if we have any concerns that we haven't thought of today. Mr. Putman?
Mr. Chair, just let me say one thing, and that's if you think about the graying of the fleet, you've heard that talked about many times. This is an effort to open up new fisheries so that those kids that are out there that want to become fishermen can get started in a fishery without having to buy a limited entry permit, can actually become a fisher and get out there and get on the water. And so they don't have to necessarily find the money to get a loan, to get a boat, to get a permit, and all the things they have to go through. This may be a way for them to get into fishery a lot easier. So that's generally the concept.
Great. Yep.
And with that, I'm take any more questions or get out of the hot seat.
I think we're good. Thank you very much, Mr. Putman. We'll set this bill aside and take it up again, probably at a future hearing.
Thank
so
you very much.
With that, we do have one more bill to come for us, and that is an introduction of HB 30. That is a bill by Representative Josephson titled Workers' Compensation death and permanent partial impairments. So with that, Representative Josephson, as well as your staff, looks like you've got Elise Sorum-Burke. If you can put yourselves on the record and introduce it, and then from there we will have the fiscal notes before us. Looks like maybe two fiscal notes, and ask any questions of the representative, and then we'll also set this bill aside as well. So with that, if you can both put yourself on the record.
Andy Josephson, House District 17, Anchorage.
Elise Sorum-Burke, staff to Representative Josephson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chairman, and appreciate the calendaring of House Bill 30. Just for the committee's information, the authors of the two fiscal notes are in the room with us. I will try to move as expeditiously as I can. I first took up the permanent partial impairment bill in 2014, and so the fact that it's Groundhog Day is meaningful to me. It seems very apropos. The bill had a hearing under a different number in 2015. It passed out of the House in 2018. It moved to the Senate Finance Committee, where it met its fate. In 2019, a unique death benefit that 12 other states have was removed. It was not liked by some members. The bill without that death benefit, sort of a clean bill, and I'll tell you what I mean by that, passed in 2020. Several members of this committee voted for it. In fact, at least, including myself, four or five of the members of this committee voted for essentially the same bill before us. The bill is supported by the Pipe Trades Association, Carpenters Union, and the AFL. Just as a reminder, I know you all know this, but a permanent partial impairment is an injury that is suffered and determined by a medical doctor. It's permanent in nature. There's no fixing the body part. It's partial. The worker is still alive, thankfully. It's an impairment. The worker is not 100%. The rating that we operate under is called the whole body rating. Some states do it body part by body part. What we do is we ask a doctor, how damaged is this individual? They'll say 3%, or they'll say 30%. And then we multiply that times the whole body number. And that is the main thing that we're trying to modify here. Our whole body number in law is, I believe, $177,000. It puts us somewhere in the bottom 10. It may even be the bottom 5 nationally. So we want to lift that up. It hasn't been changed in 22 years. Again, no changes, 22 years, to $273,000. I would note that, right now, if you use an inflation adjuster calculation, you'd be really at around $286,000. That would be a friendly amendment, I think, consistent with the purpose of the bill. So the bill is basically an update of all the categories relating to permanent partial impairment, principally the big one, of course, being this figure I've just talked about, but also some other things. For example, if a family member dies, so most of this bill, well, that the first thing concerns an injury and survival, thankfully. But if a family member dies and has dependents, the rate that they would get for a fixed payment was stuck in 1968. As I say, as a student of history, that was the middle of the Vietnam War. And so we thought maybe it was time to update that rate. So that's principally what it does. We in the last section, we take an anti-elitist position. And what I mean by that is the current law says unless you're in a four-year baccalaureate or trade school program, if your sole surviving parent is the decedent, so if you're raised by one parent and that parent dies, then you would get essentially the benefit, or you would get assistance with your scholarship effectively for 4 years till age 23. We say, no, we're not going to require a student to be in this particular category, and if they're doing something else meaningful with their lives, they would get it. And that's why I say it's sort of anti-elitist. It applies to all folks between, young people between age 19 and 23. The one thing I do want to spend some time talking about is premiums. The file history is replete with evidence that Mr. Collins can testify to, and already has testified to, about decreasing premium rates. So there's this anecdotal belief, if you walk around the state, that premiums are surely rising. They're really not. They're actually falling, and particularly in this category, which is indemnity. So they may not be, there may be some less decrease, although I think we're going to find they're still decreasing, for medical. So that's where there's a way to keep you alive and fix you. What I'm talking about is indemnity, and that's where we can't fix a body part or you've died. In that category, the cost of covering indemnity has dropped. And mind you, indemnity itself is only about 14.5% of the whole pie. So we're not talking about all workers' comp law. We're talking about a sliver of it. And in that sliver, you're seeing large decreases in the multiples of 10%. I think we're going to see that they're like 40%. You might understandably say, how is this possible? A lot of it has to do with improved workplace safety. But the cost of the bill for the state, now mind you, this is the fiscal note that says for the cost of the bill for all workers in the state is likely to be in the range of $4.8 million. And that may sound like a lot, but there's you know, hundreds of thousands of workers. So we're spreading that around. And yes, the reports will identify that this will cause premiums to go up a couple percent, but they've dropped 14% in, I think, something like the last several years. So we're still way down in the net negative in terms of the trend lines on premiums. So that's the main thing this bill does. I just wanted to highlight a couple things, and I've done this before, but to give you an example of how poorly, frankly, we treat our injured workers, and I don't mean to be tough on us, but I think that's an accurate statement. If someone loses an arm at work in Alaska, now this is a few years old, but this is roughly going to be accurate because and it's going to be roughly accurate because we've not adjusted the PPI rating. A person who loses an arm in Alaska would receive $106,000 in permanent partial impairment award. In the highest state of Pennsylvania, they would receive $389,000. We are about 45th in the loss of an arm. In the loss of an eye, we are also 45th. In Maryland, if you lose an eye at work, the system will pay you just over $250,000 for that lost eye that you can't use anymore. $250,000. Here we pay $44,000 for that lost eye. So we can do better, and we can do better in a way that, frankly, we must do better. And it's affordable because premiums are falling anyway. And with that, I will answer any questions and turn it over to Ms. Sorenberg.
Great. Do we have any questions for Representative Josephson? Representative Merrick?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Josephson, how many people receive a permanent partial impairment every year?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, I'm trying to recall, but Mr. Collins will surely know that number. Okay.
And we will be going to Mr. Collins when we get to the fiscal notes. Is that okay? Representative Edgman, Wool, and Ortiz.
Well, first, I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward. I guess just thinking in terms of the amount of federal money coming into the state, the amount of manpower, and I mean that in a gender-neutral manner, men and women who are going to be out there actually making these highways, roads, airports, whatever come about, you know, not to mention some pretty extreme weather events that we've had. And there was you know, an incident back in my home region, and thankfully the individual didn't lose a limb, but it was out of his control, the weather circumstances. So I want to just say, convey my appreciation, because I think that the bill is highly commendable. But to get to my question, and I'm guilty, I've not been able to read the bill pack. I'll just be straight with you on that. Can you give me a better sense of understanding of who this pertains to, state workers, private workers, so on and so forth?
Through the chair, it applies to every worker that is an employee. I think I'm right about that. Mr. Collins can clarify. Basically, if you're self-employed and you own a business, you're not likely to be covered by workers' comp. You're likely to be self-insured. It could be that there's some pool that you could enter into. I don't know. But basically, this would apply to white-collar workers, blue-collar workers. Of course, the latter are more prone to get injured. I'll give you an example. I had a campaign manager in 2014, and I purchased workers' compensation for my campaign manager. And I think that that's, frankly, for the coming season, something the Department of Labor wants us to do. So it really applies very, very broadly.
Follow up?
Yes, I think in a ballot measure 2 environment, that might be highly recommended.
And it looks like Ms. Sorenberg has something.
Yes. Elise Sorenberg, for the record. Through the chair, Rep. Edgman, there is a separate category for fishermen that are not covered by workers' compensation. That's worth noting as well.
Thank you.
Okay. And I need to keep a better eye on our folks on the teams here. Have them go first here. I've got Representative Carpenter and Representative Laban, and then Representative Wool and Representative Ortiz. Representative Carpenter?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think Mr. Laban here was, Representative Laban was first, but I think we've got plenty of time. Question I've got is, and I appreciate the conversation because this is an important conversation to have, for the sponsor or whoever might better answer the question, doesn't matter to me. When we compare the state's permanent partial impairment number currently that is paid to national averages or what other states do, are we also considering what the total compensation package is, not just the dollar figure that is for the payment? You know, for example, we've got a retraining process and a cost that is borne by the state through this indemnity process, and not all states do that. So a larger dollar figure at the state level for certain states might not include the retraining process that's figured into that dollar figure that the individual receives. So I'm curious to know how does ours compare to those states that don't pay that that retraining or have their own retraining process and it's not a lump sum? That would be my first question, and I'll just pause for the answer.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think that this is going to be less generous than you might anticipate, with great respect. I would encourage Mr. Collins to testify about that, but I think if my conversation with him was heard correctly by me, it could very well be that you take either the award or the retraining or perhaps some combination of the two, but not both. Now, this was a conversation I had very, very recently with Mr. Collins. But, you know, if you've lost remember that there's no way to sue short of third-party liability. If the ladder gives out and the rung of the ladder was defective, you could sue the ladder company, I believe. But that's a rare phenomenon. Mostly, this is designed to avoid litigation because we would fill up the courthouses with injuries, injury lawsuits. So the worker takes less, considerably less, as you can see. You lose an eye and you get $44,000. I think you'd do better in personal injury court if it wasn't a workplace situation, a lot better. So this is part of the grand bargain. It's designed to move things expeditiously, and there's give and take. The employers give because it's no fault. You were clumsy in the ladder, you were clumsy in the ladder. It's okay to be clumsy in the ladder, although you got injured. You don't have to explain why you were clumsy in the ladder, if you take my point. It's just sort of strict liability. But on the other hand, the employee is not going to recover what they would otherwise. But I would encourage Mr. Collins to answer the two questions that have been posed, Ms. Representative Merricks and Carpenter.
We could have Mr. Collins come up. I'm not sure we've got Mr. Collins in the room here. And if you can put yourself on the record, and we can repeat the questions if needed, or if you want to jump right in.
Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, through the chair. For the first question for Co-Chair Merrick, the exact number of claims that involve PPI, I don't know off the top of my head. What I can tell you is that in 2020, we paid out $7.3 million in PPI benefits, just the permanent partial impairment. Many claims will have a number of different indemnity portions. As was related earlier, there could, you know, an injured worker could elect to have reemployment and rehabilitation benefits also, depending on how they decide in their plan, which can be different for each injured employee on each claim, how those payments would work out. Some claimants are able to, maybe when they looked at reemployment, they had another career that would preclude them from getting those employment dollars that way, and so they may just take a lump sum on PPI. And some are doing retraining. If you go to retraining and you have a PPI benefit, your PPI benefits are paid to you as replacement wages until those are out, and then depending on the system, it gets complicated from there, but there are other wage replacements depending. So I don't remember the second question that
Representative, was that Carpenter? If you could repeat the question, Representative Carpenter, we've got Mr. Collins up at the table.
I'll do my best. The question was regarding the money that is a PPI ban in conjunction with a retraining dollar figure, and then what if we compare the total benefit to national averages on what the other states are doing. Are we comparing apples to apples in the sense that other states also do retraining, or do some dollar figures that the states use as a PPI figure are they without the state portion of retraining? You know, if we're paying $90,000 to $120,000 towards retraining, then you add that to the dollar figure that we're discussing here, then we're up in a top strata of compensation. But I'm curious how, if we're comparing apples to apples.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So all benefits in workers' compensation, of course, are paid by employers or their carriers. And I say or because we do have 24 self-insured entities, the state of Alaska being one of them, where they would pay those benefits directly instead of through an insurance company. But reemployment benefits in the state of Alaska under 2330.041 are limited in scope and amount. So, for instance, you go and get an evaluation. If you're found eligible for reemployment benefits, they develop a plan for you to go to school. The most they can pay is $13,300 in reemployment benefits. The caveat to that, of course, is wage replacement, what's called 041K, so 2330-041, letter K, pays you a weekly stipend as you go through your retraining up until it's done. As for other jurisdictions, almost all jurisdictions outside of Alaska, workers' compensation being an entity that is, each jurisdiction has its own set of laws. There's no, there are no two states that are the same. Those benefits are different in every state. For instance, in the state of Washington, everything is done through the state. So you buy your insurance policy, so to speak, from the state. And so, and your retraining is through the state and everything. And in Alaska, it's, you know, the state stays out of it, and it's run through the employers or the carriers' organization. And so, we, while sometimes I believe in 2020, there was about $7 million in replacement wages through 041K paid out on 111 active plans on any given day, and those plans date back several years and up through current. So at any given time, you know, there's people working through the system, and they will accept some of those 041K job replacement or wage replacement things, and that's by far the most expensive portion of it. It should be noted, there is also an out in 2330-041 where people can just take a job dislocation settlement. But that, even if they do either one of those, PPI payments can be paid directly and normally are paid directly to the injured employee.
A follow-up, and just to confirm, Mr. Chairman, if possible.
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you. So if I understand you correctly, the permanent partial impairment payment is something that gets paid, and then in addition to that, there is a retraining process that the individual is able to go through. Is that an accurate statement?
That is an accurate statement. However, if somebody elects to do a retraining, before they can collect 041K payments, they have to utilize their PPI. So if they have a rated PPI that only can be given by a doctor, there's a formula that they go through, and they get X amount of dollars, they use that weekly, that comes to them as a weekly stipend in that case, if they're in a retraining plan, instead of 041K. Now, if they run out of PPI, so maybe they just have a 6% or something, and it's $11,000 or $12,000, and they run through that in 20 weeks, and their plan is still ongoing, there is a possibility that they could get additionally some 041K weekly wage replacements. It should be noted those plans have to be signed off on by the employer also, not just the employee and the department.
Another follow-up if I can.
Yes, follow-up.
So it is a little bit more complex than I've originally understood, and I also think that if we're comparing ourselves to other states and their systems are likewise complex, then it isn't as simple as just comparing the PPI payment. We have to take into consideration the entire package, compare that to other states as to whether that's a total package or whether that's just their PPI payment. And I don't see that right now. So I was hoping that somebody would be able to provide that so we would better understand that. And then I will be quiet for a minute and pose another question later. Let others talk.
Thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my first question maybe is partly observation, but it appears the purpose of this is to bring the benefits up to at least a hold harmless level with inflation. Is that a general observation that's a valid one?
Through the chair, 100% correct.
Yes. And then as a follow-up, Madam Chair, the sponsor of the bill mentioned that the premium rates have been going down over the last 20 years for employers. Is that because the number of claims have also been going down?
I think that, through the chair, I think Mr. Collins is better situated to answer, but I think we're going to hear from him that indemnity claims are going down. But I would ask Mr. Collins to answer that.
Yes, Mr. Collins?
And this bill is about indemnity claims.
Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, through the chair, Representative LeBon. Yeah, for the past 9 years, the actuary for the state of Alaska, NCCI, has recommended and has been approved lowering of the premium rates for workers' compensation in Alaska. Most of that has two factors. One, Alaska is a safer place to work. I'm going to say that's probably true for most states as jobs have changed over time. And secondly, with the adoption of a fee schedule based on relative values instead of usual and customary, as was 8-9 years ago, the medical portion has also reduced, the spend on medical has, so they have lowered those rates. The latest NCCI rating for this year, which went into effect at the first of the year, lowered rates for most employers a little over 13%.
Yeah, that's good news, and thank you for that answer. And if I may, Madam Chair, just maybe an observation. Early in my professional career, I had an employer that offered accidental death and disability insurance for the employees, and the premiums were shared 50-50 between the employer and the employee. I don't know how common that is around Alaska, but I took advantage of that, as most of my fellow workers took advantage of having that supplemental program, if you will, over and above workman's comp. And it just seemed like that was a good private sector kind of answer to maybe the workman's comp benefit was not as robust as it should have been. So that was just commentary. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lebon. Are there questions in the room? Representative Edgman.
Yeah, question for Mr. Collins. You mentioned Alaska is generally considered a safer place to work. I don't know, maybe there's not a direct answer to this or not, but our capital budgets, at least in the public sector, have been down considerably, and there's maybe less sort of vertical construction occurring in the state, the building of buildings and things like that. But it would strike me that Alaska, because of being Alaska, that we would not be the safest place, maybe somewhere in the middle, or because of weather conditions, freezing rain, for example, that we would be somewhere near the top, but not so.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I think that it's possible I misspoke, but maybe what I said, it is safer to work in Alaska now than it was 10, 20 years ago. Our numbers have bore that out. Throwing out last calendar year because less people worked, of course we had less claims. We've since 2015, we've had less claims on the books every year. We attribute quite a bit of that to just the safer workplace environment.
And I
guess follow up?
Yeah, just I probably didn't hear you correctly, so thank you for that.
Okay, we have questions from Representative Wool, Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter. And I'll note we have about 10 minutes left in this hearing, so we'll go ahead and finish up with those questions. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Two questions. I was earlier asked how many claims were paid out, I think, in last year or 2020, and you said $7 million. I just want to make sure I heard that number correctly. And is that $7 million simply the PPI payments, the loss of limb, loss of eye, those direct payments? Is that what the $7 million was, or was there added costs? And if there's added costs, do you know the number for just the PPI payments?
Through the chair, Representative Bull, the $7.3 million was merely the PPI payments for the last calendar year that we have. That would be 2020, believe it or not, because of our reporting. And the total spend in indemnity payments in 2020, see if I can get this far enough away to see, was $57.1 million. So that would be, everything from total disability payments to, PPI, temporary total.
Representative Wool.
Yeah, so if if thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So if this bill were to be adopted, and this basically takes what the PPI assessment was and raises it with inflation, so which hasn't been done in quite a while, fair to say that $7 million would climb up. And is this strictly out of work comp? Where exactly does this, the $7 million or whatever that number would be, where does that come from?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, the portion we're talking about in House Bill 30 of PPI is just one component, and it would probably raise that number considerably. However, that the component that is just PPI in that bill, NCCI, even with utilization going 1.25 times the amount that has been averaging over years, only raises the cost of the premiums 2.9%, just that portion of it.
Thank you. Last follow-up, please. One, I was surprised at the $7 million number. That I didn't think it would be that high, so that was informative. And maybe later after the committee, I can find out the number of incidents just to get it in perspective. Is there someone must use a calculation? The original amounts, say $44,000 for an eye or whatever for an arm. Is there a formula? I would imagine there's a formula that someone came up with to assess what that value is. And are you basically staying with that formula but just adding inflation? I'm seeing nods. So if you want to answer that on the record, that's fine.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, there is a formula. We actually use the sixth edition of the AMA guide. That's why I'm not qualified to give you a PPI number, but if you go to the doctors, there are doctors out there that actually do this for a living, and they will make a rating, and it's complicated. In fact, I spent an hour this morning doing one just to make sure that I could get the numbers right, and that was me, so luckily I'm not a doctor. But that process is done by a doctor that's certified to do a PPI rating. So if you get hurt in the state of Alaska, even if it's not your treating doctor, you may be sent to a doctor who does that rating. And for instance, if you lose your index finger, that can be up to an 11% whole body rating. That 11% is taken times the base rate, which set in the year 2000 at $177,000, and that's what the PPI rating is.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I just wanted to make a statement. Mr. Collins is still here. The reduction in the amount of on-job injuries, I feel, has to be attributed to the big programs in Alaska that nobody gets hurt on the job. Apprenticeship programs, the same thing. They teach that as one of the main things that they do besides teaching somebody how to do a particular job. And most companies will have continued training for at least once a year or more where they go back through on safety measures. So I feel like we've changed our way of doing business and the way employers treat their employees as far as trying to make sure we don't have on-job injuries. But this is really good. Thank you, Mr. Collins, for your input too.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Thompson. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And I would echo Representative Thompson in saying that our culture and our industry has changed, and we are much more safety conscious than a generation ago. My question is concerning comparison of workers' compensation worker indemnity coverage through workers' compensation and compare that to what's privately available. So if you compare workers' compensation package to what an employer might offer for life and disability insurance. What's the comparison cost here? If somebody like a private self-employed individual wanted to cover their indemnity, and they buy the insurance, How does that compare to what the state offers through a government indemnity plan?
Madam Chair, I don't have any idea. Sorry, I just can't.
So we'll follow up on that, Representative Carpenter. Okay. Is there a follow-up, Representative Carpenter?
Yeah, I just think that it's valuable to the conversation to know, you know, if we're doing workers' compensation this way, and the industry has a comparable or less expensive way of doing it, then maybe we ought to consider a different way of doing workers' compensation, and that's kind of where the question is going. I mean, I know the government involvement in just about everything makes it more expensive. So if there's a way for private employers who currently do worker indemnity, why do we continue using workers' compensation? So the question ought to start with, is there a comparable alternative that would decrease the costs for employers and the state by not duplicating efforts, so to speak? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll just say, and I think Ms. Hornberg wants to say something. Every state has workers' compensation. There are 50 formulas, as Mr. Collins said. We either offer it or we allow people to sue their employers. That's the grand bargain. It goes back to the late 1800s in Germany, I believe. I can tell you that workers' comp is relatively inexpensive per individual. Now, it depends on the nature of the work and that sort of thing. But, you know, certainly it's not inexpensive for someone who has a fleet of, you know, scores of workers that do dangerous work. That's going to cost them something. But as Mr. Collins said, and no one has disputed, the premiums have come down. Anyway, I invite the others to say anything.
Yes, Ms. Thornburg?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think it's important to remember, too, that workers' compensation is required by law for all employers to have. As Mr. Collins noted, there are some groups in the state, including the state, that are self-insured, but it is not an optional program. Also, it's a no-fault system, as Representative Josephson was referring to. So it's important to note that basically exactly what Representative Josephson said. The reason for workers' compensation has to do with liability of the employer. And whether or not the employee can sue the employer, and I'm just going to skip way ahead to the end of my slideshow, the elevator paradigm that I love to talk about. So if you have a customer and an employee in an elevator, and the elevator falls, what can they each get? The employee gets whatever workers' compensation says is due to them. I have, of course, the single childless worker on here as my example who would just get funeral expenses. What damages does the customer receive? The customer can receive economic damages, non-economic damages, pain and suffering, loss of consortium. They can receive punitive damages, and this can be a huge amount of money. So workers' compensation is here to protect employers and to provide some compensation for employees. I believe there is one state that allows it to be optional, and that would be Texas. Am I correct on that, Director Collins?
Through the chair, yes. Texas has an opt-in system.
But it is, again, as an employer, you're opening yourself up to liability if you choose not to opt in that state. So those are my comments.
Representative Carpenter, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, in the interest of time, we'll keep it brief. I understand that the currently state law in the state and probably all others require some sort of participation in the system or self-insurance, and that's been around for a very long time. Just because we've always done it that way doesn't mean that's the way we have to do it into the future. And I remember when I first started working as a young employee, I was never offered any sort of disability insurance. I'm not sure whether it was a thing back then. And now it is very common to see that as part of your package. And so if the state, through a workers' compensation plan, is providing that and it costs an employer amount, what is the net cost of providing that through the state government versus what that employer could find through the same types of policy in the private sector? I'm not saying that we shouldn't have insurance or require an insurance for the liability piece of it. I'm just asking if we're doing it the least costly way. And instead of just throwing a bunch of money and increasing our payments, let's ask some questions about how we're actually doing the business from the big picture. And I'll leave it at that for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. We'll take questions from Representatives Edgman and Thompson, and then we'll go over the fiscal notes as we have folks that have been waiting for that. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Collins. I was on the Workers' Compensation Board from 1984 to 1994, and if I remember correctly, we had inspectors go out. We were finding a lot of employers that did not have workers' compensation, and I don't know if we're still tracking that, because that drives up the cost usually for people that do pay workers' comp insurance. Do we still pursue catching people that are cheating the system and not having to pay workers' comp insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the state employs 5 full-time inspectors that spend their time on that. Let it be known, and you can see it in our KPIs as we rate it, that less than 0.1% of Alaskan employers have no insurance, what we call failure to insure. Those that we catch, and we catch them, all the fines that we collect on that plus interest goes to fund the benefits guarantee fund, which pays for those employees that happen to end up working for somebody that is not insured and they incur some costs, same rate as everybody else. So the state has done an excellent job both at taking care to make sure that employers are following the law and also taking care of those employees that somehow got through that. So, and thank you for your service.
Thank you very much, Mr. Collins, and I'm glad to hear that that is still being pursued and it's working and you're catching people. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Quickly, we'll go over the fiscal notes. From the Department of Labor, we still have Chuck Collins to go over fiscal note control code GCREY. Mr. Collins?
So, through the chair, Chuck Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, the fiscal note shows no cost to the state. However, premium rates were to rise as we forecast through NCCI's thing, that since workers' compensation insurance premiums are paid to the Division of Insurance, there's a fee on the amount of that. I believe it's 2.9% by statute, and so believe it or not, we'd actually gain revenue because higher sales of premiums. And that's reflected in our fiscal note there.
Great, thank you. Are there questions? Thank you, Mr. Collins. We appreciate you being here. Next from the Department of Administration, we have Scott Jordan, Director of the Division of Risk Management, and he's gonna go over fiscal note control code VPKQM. Mr. Jordan, if you put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Jordan. I'm the Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. And as you identify the fiscal note, you should have in front of you with a date of 1/28 of January this year. The fiscal note, do you want me to go through it piece by piece or whatever?
Just a general overview, I think, is okay. Fine, and we can go into further detail should we need it at a further meeting.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. The fiscal note is for $449,000 per year run out to fiscal year 2028. This amount is to cover the increase, which is about 54% from the current whole body impairment of $177,000 to the proposed amount of $273,000. This amount that we've proposed as 449 is generated by doing a 10-year average, the last 10 years of PPIs that we've paid out. So we're looking at 423,254 as the PPI amount increase, and then there's also a fee, which I think Director Collins was talking about, was the second injury fund, which is 6%, so we add 6% onto that.
Okay, are there questions? Seeing none, thank you for being here, Mr. Jordan. And finally, we have Caroline Schultz from OMB. She'll review fiscal note control code DESMT. Ms. Schultz.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. This is Caroline Schultz from the Office of Management and Budget. There is a zero fiscal note for the department Various to represent all branches. This is a fiscal note designed to accompany Mr. Jordan's fiscal note. This fiscal note merely indicates that while Mr. Jordan's fiscal note increased the risk management rates by $449,000, we will not be increasing the associated budget for all departments by that amount.
Thank you, Ms. Schultz. Are there questions? Seeing none, thank you for being here. And this concludes our meeting for today. We'd like to thank Representative Josephson for bringing up House Bill 30. This concludes our meeting, and our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 p.m., where we will hear presentations on federal funding from the Office of Management and Budget. With that, we are adjourned at 3:37 p.m. Thank you.